This was a difficult case to manage. While a multiple injured patient might have been overwhelming to an unprepared candidate, the candidate in this scenario handled the case correctly because he followed a methodical, organized approach and adhered to the rules I have previously discussed. He correctly identified the four potentially life-threatening conditions that were present in this patient: acute epidural hematoma, traumatic rupture of the thoracic aorta, femoral fracture, and abdominal hemorrhage. And all the while, he followed the absolute rules required for safe and successful stabilization and diagnosis. Let's analyze how this was done. The candidate was presented with a multiple injured patient with abnormal vital signs, an altered level of consciousness, and clues toward the diagnosis of each injury. The candidate began his management by following the first three rules, which I will review here. Rule number one: all patients with abnormal vital signs or an altered level of consciousness require immediate stabilization. Rule number two: if you are dealing with potentially serious injuries, be aggressive in your management so that stabilization is achieved. Rule number three: take the lead. Take control of the case yourself. And as I will point out later, he also adhered to rule number four, which is this: never let up on your concentration. Because the patient had abnormal vital signs, hypertension and tachycardia, as well as an altered level of consciousness, the candidate went straight to the ABCs, or as I like to approach it in the injured patient, CABC, that is, C-spine immobilization and airway evaluation first, then breathing and circulation. He immediately discovered the loss of the gag reflex and was aggressive in his decision to intubate early on in the case. This was followed quickly by aggressive IV fluid therapy and placing the patient on O2, a pulse oximeter, and a cardiac monitor. Beyond this stage, the candidate logically, safely, and correctly diagnosed each of the injuries in this patient because he stuck to his plan and his case management technique, which I will review here. 1. Initial stabilization. 2. Brief history and physical exam. 3. Initial lab orders. 4. Specific treatment as indicated. 5. Complete history and physical. 6. Diagnostic impression. 7. Additional diagnostic studies. 8. Specialty consultation as needed. 9. Final stabilization and treatment. And 10. Final disposition. Notice that he never became distracted. He maintained his sense of rhythm. His ping-pong volley was smooth and steady, all because he stuck to his management plan and kept his concentration up. I'm going to talk about particular management aspects of this case in a moment. But before I do that, I want to emphasize the importance of weaving your bedside manner through these 10 steps. If the patient is awake, you should always introduce yourself. If he is anxious, reassure him. If you need to perform an invasive procedure or give a med, explain what you are doing and why. When you have arrived at a diagnostic impression, tell the patient. And if you don't know what's wrong, tell him that too. Explain what studies you are ordering and why. And finally, explain to the patient what your conclusions are. Discuss with him any treatment options and finalize disposition of his care. Now I'd like to talk about particular management aspects of this case in greater detail. You may have noticed that, unlike most of the case studies in the text, attention to certain aspects of the physical exam and some procedures such as tracheal intubation and IVs was not given in any great detail. There's a reason for this. In a single encounter, the candidate has 15 to 20 minutes to manage the case. Where there are multiple critical problems that require efficient and competent care in a single patient, the examiner will want you to focus your attention on these problems. He wants to know that you will identify them as quickly as possible, pursuing all avenues that will lead to accurate assessment and treatment. In this case, the limited amount of time the candidate had needed to be spent on the critical problems since they were multiple. Conversely, if you are given a patient with multiple injuries, only one of which is crucial to patient survival, the examiner will want you to pursue the physical exam in detail and will allow you the time to do so. Likewise, he may also ask you more pertinent questions about the procedures you are doing. My advice is this: follow the direction of the initial assessment. In this case, the need for aggressive airway management and the possibility of a femoral fracture surfaced immediately. This was followed quickly by the recognition of a potentially life-threatening head injury in an unconscious patient, as well as evidence of a possible major intrathoracic injury. Finally, the head injury alone dictated the need for abdominal CT. Now let's review the critical actions in this case and discuss them in detail. There were 6 critical actions. 1. Tracheal intubation. 2. Lateral C-spine film. 3. CT scans of the head and abdomen. 4. Aortography. 5. Mechanical ventilation and diuretics to treat increased intracranial pressure. And 6. Diagnosis of a femoral fracture. For many years, nasotracheal intubation was preferred over standard orotracheal intubation in the major trauma victim, particularly those with possible neck injuries. However, it has been shown that both techniques produce the same amount of neck movement. With the advent of rapid sequence induction, nasotracheal intubations have fallen dramatically in the management of major trauma victims. Orotracheal intubation with inline manual cervical immobilization is the procedure of choice. It should be noted here that in ABEM's selected reading list, there is an article on difficult airway management. In it, nasotracheal intubation is reported to be a viable option in routine intubation as well as difficult airway management, especially when a directional tip control tube is utilized. That may be so, but the fact is, nasotracheal intubation is indicated only if clear contraindication exists to RSI and other airway modalities are not available, including retrograde intubation. Absolute contraindications to nasotracheal intubation include coagulopathy and midfacial or basilar skull fractures. Obtaining a portable lateral C-spine film is of paramount importance in the initial assessment of the multiple injured patient. Until a fracture or dislocation is safely ruled out with this view, the neck cannot be moved in order to obtain a complete series of the cervical spine. Signs of a traumatically induced thoracic aortic rupture are often subtle. The initial clue was the high blood pressure measurement in a patient who would usually be normotensive or even hypotensive in the presence of a femoral fracture and intraperitoneal bleeding. A typical finding is hypertension in the upper extremities and hypotension in the lower extremities. If you'll remember, the pulses in both lower extremities were reported as weak. It should be noted here that patients with a traumatically induced aortic rupture frequently present with hypotension rather than hypertension in the upper extremities. I chose to use the latter presentation in this case in order to give the candidate a clue to the diagnosis. Had I chosen to make him hypotensive, the diagnosis may have been missed, as it frequently is in clinical practice in patients with other obvious causes of hypotension. Always be suspicious of this injury in any patient who has been in a vehicular accident at speeds exceeding 45 miles per hour. The finding of nonspecific swelling on the anterior chest wall was the second clue. Some patients with an aortic tear don't have any signs of external chest injury. The third clue was the finding of a soft systolic ejection murmur heard over the region of the aortic valve. This murmur results from an associated tear of the aortic valve, which is attached to the proximal aorta. The fourth clue was obliteration of the aortic knob on chest X-ray. This may be difficult to assess on a film taken with the patient in a supine position. If possible, a film should be taken with the patient in a near upright position to confirm this finding, as well as the presence of a widened mediastinum. If the patient's vital signs remain stable, aortography is indicated, not only to confirm or rule out the diagnosis, but also to rule out bleeding from mediastinal vessels, which can also present on a film with a widened mediastinum, even in the absence of injury to the aorta. This latter injury is not as serious as a ruptured thoracic aorta and may not require immediate surgical intervention. Theoretically, thoracic CT could have been done instead of a chest X-ray, especially since head and abdominal CTs were also ordered. However, even if a mediastinal hematoma is visualized on CT, aortography or helical CT angiography is still required to determine the sites of injury, as well as identify any vascular anomalies that would require modifications in the operative approach. I think a chest X-ray should be done first, and a CT of the chest ordered only if the X-ray appears normal to you and the patient requires CT for other reasons. Signs of an expanding epidural hematoma appeared early in the case, a dilating pupil reacting sluggishly to light. Usually, hyperventilation will buy time for CT scanning and for the neurosurgeon to arrive. If Lasix and mannitol are administered, it should be in consultation with a neurosurgeon and only if definitive surgery is anticipated. If the patient presents with or develops a blown pupil, one that is widely dilated and unreactive to light, uncal herniation has occurred. In this situation, immediate burr hole placement is required. If the neurosurgeon is not immediately available, either hours or miles away, then you must do it. The use of hyperventilation for increased intracranial pressure is a controversial issue. It definitely works to reduce ICP, but cerebral ischemia may result if the PCO2 falls below 30 millimeters mercury. What is unclear is how long it takes for a low PCO2 to cause cerebral ischemia and whether or not the severity of the increased pressure is a factor as well. For many years, hyperventilation was standard therapy for increased ICP, and patients would be on it for long periods of time in the intensive care unit. I suspect this is where documentation of cerebral ischemia originated. I'm not advocating hyperventilation for all head-injured patients with increased ICP. However, I do think that selective use of hyperventilation is warranted for brief periods of time in patients with neurologic deterioration, despite other efforts to reduce ICP. A CT scan of the abdomen is a critical action in this case for two reasons. 1. The patient had multiple injuries that required immediate surgical intervention. And 2. The presence of a closed head injury was a clear-cut indication to perform DPL, ultrasound, or a CT scan. In the exam setting, you will be evaluating patients in a large, university-based emergency department where CT scanning can be done in minutes and is the procedure of choice in patients who are not hypotensive, especially since current clinical practice favors conservative therapy for solid organ injuries. That being said, I would like to clarify the role of bedside ultrasound in the trauma patient with multiple injuries. Multi-trauma patients should receive a fast exam as part of the initial assessment only if they are stable. Unstable patients require stabilization and operative management as quickly as possible without delays for diagnostic testing. As emergency physicians and surgeons become more adept at performing and interpreting portable ultrasound, this skill is likely to become part of the physical exam performed in the ED while awaiting arrival of the surgeon or transport to the OR. Femoral fractures may or may not be associated with significant sequestration of blood. In general, femoral fractures with displacement and overriding are more frequently associated with severe blood loss than are simpler fractures, such as this patient had. Important assessment criteria in this patient included the following: diagnosis of the femoral fracture and determination of the presence or absence of peripheral pulses. While a peripheral neurological assessment is also important, this is difficult, if not impossible, to evaluate in an unconscious patient, and in any case, his other injuries were of greater immediate concern. At no time during the assessment of this patient was it determined how this accident occurred, although it was suggested by the suspicion of a thoracic aortic rupture. You might find it helpful to note that rapid deceleration injuries are of a tearing nature. The ligamentum arteriosum tears at its attachment to the aorta, causing the thoracic portion to dissect. The ligamentum teres, which runs from the umbilicus to the liver, can tear, thus splitting the liver right down the middle. Organ attachments to the mesentery can also be torn loose, particularly those of the kidney, intestines, and spleen. Epidural hematomas are caused by tears of arterial vessels, and yes, even the femoral fracture can be caused by the rapid deceleration. The force is transmitted from the knee as it hits the dashboard, with the shaft of the femur and its ligamentous attachments absorbing the force of the impact. More commonly, however, the force is transmitted through the femoral shaft to the hip joint, resulting in a posterior dislocation of the hip with concomitant fracture. This was really a tough case, wasn't it? I never had a single patient with all of these findings, but I've always known it was possible. Just writing about it widened my pulse pressure. It takes a lot of self-control and a disciplined, methodical approach to handle a case like this with expertise. I want to tell you about a novel I read entitled Space by James Michener, in which he vividly described the reactions of test pilots as they take their jets through difficult maneuvers. I was particularly interested in his description of the actions taken by a test pilot when something goes wrong at 40,000 feet and the aircraft begins a rapid descent, spiraling its way toward the ground. I could just imagine the frantic efforts of the pilot as he tried to correct the problem. But you know, that's not what happens. As he is plummeting downward, he is very methodically performing all of the functions of a well-trained, thoroughly rehearsed pilot, and he does them in a certain order, knowing that he's most likely to make the right correction in time if he sticks to his ingrained performance pattern. And that's what you need to do when confronted with a challenging clinical problem. A solid routine based on established priorities, executed in a methodical manner, is the key to successful management of a difficult case. This is the end of the first case study.